My dream world, I feel like this is my theory. I think that there's not going to be any race. We're just going to be one race because, you know, as like racism and all this stuff is slowly dying, I think we're all going to start fucking each other. And we're just going to be one race. And we're going to be learning about African Americans and like, we're going to be learning about Asians and just all types of people because we're going to be having sex with each other because none of this like weird dividing is going on. And that's my theory too. Like, I feel like Martin Luther King, he had a dream, but it became reality. And I think that my theory is real. It's not even a dream, it's just gonna happen. My name's Sudan Archives, and you're listening to the Specs Podcast.
Herzlich willkommen zur zweiten Ausgabe unseres Specs Podcasts. Euch erwartet hier heute ein Gespräch mit Pop-Theoretiker Simon Reynolds, meinem Kollegen Julian Dörr und mir, Jesse Hughes, und im Anschluss eine neue Kolumne von Musikerin und Rapperin Ebru Düzgün, besser bekannt als Ebo. Zurück zu unserem ersten Podcast-Gast. Simon Reynolds, geboren Anfang der 60er Jahre in London, mittlerweile lebhaft in L.A., der war jetzt im November unterwegs durch Deutschland auf einer Lesereise. Grund dafür ist ein Buch, das Anfang nächsten Jahres zum ersten Mal auf Deutsch veröffentlicht wird und das, obwohl es dann schon sein 25. Jubiläum feiert. 1995, da wurde es zuerst veröffentlicht, das erste Buch von Simon Reynolds, das er damals zusammen mit Joy Press geschrieben hat. The Sex Revolts, Gender Rebellion and Rock'n'Roll, so der Titel. Wer bei Songs wie Under My Thumb von den Rolling Stones schon mal genauer hingehört hat, dem schwant vielleicht jetzt schon, worum es in diesem Buch ungefähr gehen könnte. In unglaublich vielen Songs der Musikgeschichte kommen Frauen gar nicht besonders gut weg. Vor allem in der frühen Rockgeschichte, da werden Frauen häufig angefeindet, diskriminiert und dominiert. Wie konnte es eigentlich dazu kommen? Wie kann es sein, dass sich hinter befreiender Rebellion dermaßen misogyne Züge versteckt haben? Dass sich Bands wie The Stranglers, The Rolling Stones und viele mehr frauenfeindliche Texte leisten konnten und trotzdem geliebt wurden und nach wie vor geliebt werden? Nicht nur solche Lyrics haben Reynolds und Press in Sex Revolts analysiert, sondern die Ursachen für Machotum, Rockismus und Frauenfeindlichkeit in der Musik in einen gesellschaftspolitischen Kontext gestellt und, für die Zeit der Erstveröffentlichung ganz besonders, den Keim der aufkommenden Gender Studies mit aufgegriffen. Über dieses Buch Sex Revolts sprechen wir hier jetzt in den nächsten 50 Minuten. Mein Kollege Julian Dörr und ich, Jesse Hughes, gemeinsam mit Autor Simon Reynolds. Dann erfahrt ihr, warum das Buch nach wie vor relevant ist und wie es heute in der Musikwelt und vor allem in der Rockmusik eigentlich so aussieht. Viel Spaß beim Gespräch. Wir hören uns danach wieder mit einer Kolumne von Ebo. What was the initial reason to write the book?
Well, my wife and I, Joy Press, my co-author and wife, we had gone out for dinner with a friend who had a musician friend who was in town. And this guy was in various sort of edgy, noisy bands. And during the course of the evening, he told this joke, which goes like this. What's the worst thing about raping a child? Having to kill her afterwards. And it was like a sort of sick joke that, you know, you're meant to sort of, it's a kind of test of how cool you are. Because if you can laugh at that, that shows you're kind of, you have that sort of cold detachment. You just enjoy the structure of the joke, the nasty surprise, and the sick humor. But, you know, if you think about it, you know, it's a pretty horrible topic for humor. And we didn't laugh, and he probably thought we were sort of humorless, left-wing, progressive people or something like that. And but we were going home afterwards, thinking about, at that time, there were a lot of bands who had songs about killing women. Like, it was sort of like almost a standard topic of certain kind of alternative rock of the late 80s and early 90s. And we wondered why this was such a... You know, and some of these were bands that I particularly liked just because of the intensity and the visceral excitement of the noise, this group Big Black. I'd been a big fan of Nick Cave and The Birthday Party and The Bad Seeds, and had a lot of songs about murdering women. And we were just like, why is this a topic? Why is this a theme? What is it saying? And then we started talking very animatedly for several hours about all these different manifestations of misogyny in rock. And then we thought, well, this could be a book. And that was the initial idea. It was actually going to be only about sort of misogyny and masculinity, like, you know, hyper-masculine fantasies. But then we sort of started thinking more and more, well, men aren't always saying bad stuff about women. They have mystical, idealized views of women as well that that are better, but they're in their own way confining, and they are, you know, a sort of a confining role or of confining fantasy that may not be of any value to actual real women in the world. And then we thought, well, and then women have their own representation of themselves, their own forms of rebellion, their own fantasies of becoming, you know, escaping whatever society has laid out for them. And so we thought, well, let's do it as this three part book, you know, the masculine, misogynist, rebel thing, and these dreamy, psychedelic boys with their fantasies of being a child again, and then women, which is like a whole series of different strategies and images and personas and things like that. So it, you know, it was a big topic. and we didn't, you know, it doesn't cut, it's a sort of a history of rock through the lens of gender, but it doesn't cover the whole history of rock. There's a lot that we don't look at. We looked at the things that seemed to be most rich in terms of what you could say, you know, and what you could analyze, you know, and what lent itself to writing excitingly about this topic. And it's not the only story in rock. There's the story of youth, there's dancing, there's the electric guitar, there's all these other things that rock is about. But this is one way you can look at rock and you trace how it's evolved over time.
Yeah. Was the guy a musician? The guy telling the joke?
Yeah, he was, yeah. I won't identify him, but he was in quite a well-known, notorious band at that time. There was a kind of culture around then of, it wasn't just bands, there were like sort of fanzines, you know, that were sold alongside rock fanzines, but they were fans, like a fanzine of murder, like, you know, the most horrible murders of all time, or the most, you know, the serial killers who kill 50 people or something. Mm-hmm. And an interest in all kinds of shocking, horrible things, extremes of human psychology. And there were also publishers who published books of this sort of strange, grotesque, weird stuff.
Yeah.
And often there was this sort of feeling of like a sort of kind of admiration for these guys for being so single-minded and mm-hmm. pursuing their desires, you know.
Rebellious,
yeah,
one could say.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And like, you know, just sort of like not being a normal person, but just following their own path, you know. And you could see a certain sense of like not so concealed excitement in these figures. And that was interesting. It's a bit like the cult of Charles Manson. That's been a thing in rock for a long while.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And Guns N' Roses covered one of his songs. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people in rock culture seem to have this view of Charlie Manson as this kind of cool dude. But he was a racist, paranoid, very manipulative, nasty person.
Yeah.
You know? But there's some sort of weird connection of Manson and rock culture.
Yeah. I was wondering, because at the time that you brought out the book in 1995, you'd probably started writing it a couple of years earlier. It was like the era of the Riot Girl movement as well at the same time.
Yeah.
So this issue was kind of cooking up again. Was that a reason as well why you thought this would be a good timing for the book to come out?
That was definitely part of the feeling that there was this upsurge of interesting, very fierce female expression. And I think I did a piece the sort of concept was like angry women in rock, because there was Hole, there was Babes in Toyland, there was a few other groups at that time who were kind of like the female grunge people, and even had an interesting relationship to some extent with the bands who were all about songs about killing women, because often they were influenced by them or liked that sound, but they were writing it from the other side about kind of abject or disturbing things, but from a female perspective. And so that was interesting. And then it was just, there was PJ Harvey had come along. Liz Phair came out with this album that was like meant to be an answer record to the Rolling Stones, you know, called Exile in Guyville. And then in a completely different way, you had someone like Bjork. So there was a lot of interesting, unusual, forceful female expression. And then Riot Girl obviously was, you know, very overtly feminist and bringing up all these issues. And so that was definitely like one of the backdrops to the whole thing. We had also been really big fans of a slightly earlier phase of groups like this band, The Throwing Muses, that had very interesting lyrics from a female perspective, and a band called Hugo Largo. And so there, from the late 80s onwards, there had been sort of, even at the same time as all these strange, noisy groups with songs about killing women, there had been all these other sort of interesting characters coming along in rock, talking about female experience in a sort of very visceral, interesting, highly charged way.
Do you remember what the initial reception was when your book came out in 95? It fell in this, like, this time that you just described, and
it got a lot of attention, actually. I think it actually got a good reception in Germany and in the German speaking world. Like in Austria, it had good reviews as well. And we got a lot of attention in England. In America, we got a lot of attention, but it was more a mixed response. Like, some people felt we were unfair to the men. And often, funnily, it was female critics who were like, you know, they're too hard on the Rolling Stones, or they're too hard on all these male groups.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I think the thing was that there had been academic work on this area. Not as much as you'd think, but there had been some academic work. But there really wasn't a book. All the books before were always like women in rock books. So it's like, you know, books, female artists, very sort of positive. Here's a great female artist. Here's another one.
Yeah.
And this was a book that, what was original about it was it treated men as a gender. And it said, like, well, you know, maleness is not just the norm, that the supposedly universal backdrop to everything. And then you have the women. Maleness is a gender as well. And
that was so new, right? I mean, yeah. Gender studies were kind of just coming up nowadays. Like, I guess we're from different generations. Mm. For me, this is a very, like, common concept.
Yeah.
But then in the 90s, gender studies were only rising. I was wondering why you didn't think about writing, like, a second part of the book.
Mm.
You
mean for about the last 25 years?
Yeah.
We just, it was too big a topic to take on. We couldn't really afford to give it the time, and so we thought we'd just added a sort of bonus section of pieces that we had written, not together but separately, over the last 24 years or something, about mostly female artists. Like, there's a piece by Joy on Yoko Ono, there's one on La Tigre, I think there's one where I'm talking about a whole group of different women who do electronic music, like Maria Minerva and Laurel Halo. I'm not sure actually what the final things they settle on, but I think Bjork was another one that's in there, where I did this piece sort of looking over the whole of Bjork's career. And so it doesn't, you know, there's nothing, unfortunately, there's nothing about, say, Nicki Minaj in there or something like that. But there is a sort of sense of some of the things we write about carrying on into the nearer the present day. Quite a lot of the people who've come along in the last 20 years sort of fit into categories that we devise in the book. And you could say that there's a template there that you could understand some recent artists in. But there are also others that are kind of completely original and would need to be newly thought about. But, you know, I think we thought we'd leave that job to someone, younger people maybe.
Yeah, but it's interesting because you moved away from rock as the genre, right?
Mm.
Because
what do you mean as a journalist?
No, the examples you just gave, mm-hmm. like, they were all like not classic like rock musicians anymore, like Nicki
Minaj.
Which
says a lot about the genre as itself, I guess.
Yeah, you know, it's not entirely just this white rock tradition. that we're following. But Public Enemy are written about in the same chapter as The Clash, you know, it's sort of. Mm-hmm. But yeah, you know, I mean, I think one of the things about rock is I feel like rock, almost rock as a concept, or the idea of the rock star has become the property of hip hop in the last 5 or 6 years. And it's become very explicit with, you know, Ray Schremer doing Black Beatles, you know, and Post Malone doing Rockstar and Future calling himself Future Hendrix. There's this sort of, that sort of rebellion and that idea of Rockstar is excessive and can do anything he wants, is usually still a he. That sort of moved into hip hop. They used that way of understanding their life and the grandeur and glory of their stardom in, you know, in those sort of terms that have come down from the Rolling Stones and Led Zeppelin, people like that. But even the word rock star is just a sort of adjective people use. Like, I think there's a brand of lipstick or something called rock star. You know, it's sort of an idea of, it's a bit like the relative to the way people talk about being fabulous or fierce or glam.
Yeah.
It's a free floating term that doesn't, now, rock star is just like, I'm like living my life and totally free and
on the other
flashy.
Hand, I find it quite old fashioned. The word.
Yeah, yeah.
Which
also
says,
the concept is like it feels.
Which says a lot, yeah.
It probably is a retro term now, like the rock star. It's sort of, and I think that's one of the reasons why these films have been so popular, Bohemian Rhapsody and Rocket Man, because they are about that high peak of rock stardom as, you know, someone who's kind of out of control, at the top of the world, yeah, out of control. And and that era when, you know, Keith Moon drove a Rolls Royce into a swimming pool and kind of stuff, you know. It does seem like very so. I do sometimes think, like, in 100 years, people will look back at rock and roll's entirety and think of it as just decadence or just like some absurd, wasteful moment before everyone got sensible and saved the planet, you know. Because it's, if you look at it, how rock stars behave, I mean, it's fairly indefensible, really, a lot of what they do.
Maybe we should like wind back a little bit to get more into defining what a rock star used to be like or where rockism comes from. Mm. In your book, you start with a chapter on momism, for example, which I hadn't heard about. Can you say a little bit about that?
Yeah, that's something I remember reading about it years ago when I first started reading the music press. The writer that I really followed was this writer called Julie Burchell, who was like, she was like considered the most opinionated, judgmental, kind of almost terrifying figure, because she was so stark in her opinions and so sort of, like very funny, but like you could destroy people. I think she described David Bowie as like a piece of old meat now. You know, it's like, like 78, like she'd been a fan of him, but now he was now, in 1978, he was like completely useless and to be thrown away. And so she was really famous as the sort of the punkiest of the punk writers. And she and her partner, Tony Parsons, they did a piece about Dylan, just destroying Dylan, just saying he's irrelevant, he's useless, he was always shit. Called something like, take this God and bury him. And then he did a follow-up piece about James Dean, saying something like, take your God and stuff him or something like that. And it was like, and that's the piece I read about James Dean. And he was like this iconic figure. A lot of people had this profound formative effect on them. You know, rock and roll happens and James Dean happened at the same time. And even though he only made 2 or 3 films, and the main one is Rebel Without a Cause, a lot of people's, you know, even the way they walked or smoked a cigarette or whatever is modeled kind of on James Dean and the way they did their hair and everything. It was like an icon of rebellion. And in this piece, Julie Burchell and Tony Parsons refer to momism as this thing. And I never forgot it. And then when we started working on the book, I started researching into it. And it was a sort of popular theory explaining what was wrong with society in the late 40s and early 50s. Basically blaming mothers for everything and saying that America had grown soft because it was all about suburbia. There was this explosive growth of suburbia after the war and consumerism and popular culture, mass culture. And a lot of older Americans felt this was a decline from this masculine frontier spirit of America, you know, sort of entrepreneurs who created a country out of nothing, you know, and the country was getting soft. And there were quite a lot of books about that, written at that time. There was one called The Organization Man that was all about how people were like becoming little cogs in big companies, you know, they weren't like individuals starting their own businesses. But this particular book by this guy, Philip Wiley, called Generation of Vipers, coined this term mummism. And it's full of this virulent hatred of mothers. And mothers are blamed somehow for this thing, you know, suburbia and consumerism and conformism. But they're, you know, they're supposed to be the architects of it. But of course, they're, you know, as much the victims or more the victims of it, because, you know, often they're leading these isolated lives at home, being homemakers and feel, you know, frustrated or whatever and have no fulfillment in that life. And so, but women and particularly mothers were blamed for it. And also they're blamed for being too powerful as well. And so in the film Rebel Without a Cause, there's this whole thing, like the problems that James Dean has is that his dad is this emasculated figure. The mother is too dominant. And he's lacking a strong male role model. And it's a recurrent theme. And actually, around the time that we did the book, there was this guy called Robert Bly who started the men's movement. Mm. And a lot of his stuff was about the same idea. Men need to get tougher again. They've got soft. It's the same kind of things you see in the film Fight Club. You know, what causes the men in Fight Club to start their Fight Club is they feel like they're spending all the time shopping and...
The generation raised by women, right?
Yeah, that's they're using grooming products and worrying about their hair and, you know. And we have it now at the current moment with this guy Jordan Peterson and all this talk, you know, alt-right talk about men need, you know, men are in crisis and they don't know who they are or what they're for anymore. And, and things have got to change, go back to a... original structure.
it feels like this is as you said, like this timeline of these thoughts. It's like the patriarchal structures were like stronger back then, probably even stronger than they are now. And like all these theories that like just feel like that these male defense mechanisms to me. You know, like they have nothing to do with like the reality. Not now and not then, but it's like it's just this. We need somebody to blame, and it can't be us. Like,
yeah.
At the moment, there's going to be a reissue of the Männerfantasien by Klaus Teveleit.
Yeah.
It's going to be reissued this November, and it's a book that also inspired you, right?
Yeah. I came across that book in the late 80s, and I was just fascinated. I just read reviews of it, and I just thought, this sounds really rich, and actually used it in earlier writing on hip-hop and Public Enemy and things like that. And then for the book, we reread the first volume, and then I didn't even realize there was a second volume, I think. So we read, you know, 1,000 pages or whatever of Klaus... How do you pronounce his name?
Teveleit,
with a hard T, right. I always say... Theorite, but it's yeah. Obviously. And it's odd. It's absolutely fascinating stuff. And then what I suppose is interesting and disturbing is that the same tropes that he writes about swamping and floods and morasses are exactly the same imagery that Trump uses at all, you know, all these anti-immigrant, hard border, territorial kind of politicians use the imagery of foreigners as bringing disease and being vermin. It's the same fascist imaginary, you know. So that's what I felt. There was a sort of psychological mechanism in there that was oddly applicable to quite a few rock groups.
Which is crazy when you think that Teveleit wrote a book which described how fascism. Came to be around,
after the First World War, right? That's what you're writing about.
And often they were, you know, in the imagery of the, you know, he uses the diaries and the correspondence and the fiction of these military paramilitary groups who went around suppressing the communists in the immediate post-war years. He uses their personal writings and letters and diaries and novels to sort of probe into their desires and fears. And often their fears that, you know, it's not just communists, they fear it's communist women are like the most terrifying figures,
most evil.
You know. So they associate socialism with women in some way, and but also there are racial fears. There are all kinds of fears composed into these phantasmic figures that are the things they're fighting against and sort of building these barriers against.
Basically, just like the nanny state of the alt-right. Right,
exactly.
Like this, also the concept of like this, the state that has like too much involvement and is taking away freedom and liberties.
Yeah,
yeah. The connection you draw in the new German preface to your book, and you wrote that like the misogyny of the rock rebels then, and that you draw the connection to the new in air quotes the new rebels of the alt-right or like the different. New right, far right movements in Europe. That's a really interesting thought.
Well, I was influenced in a funny way. I was influenced by this book, Kill All Normies, by Angela Nagel, which she drew some influence from the sex revolts. But in turn, reading her book made me see, oh yeah, there are these. It's like almost like a punk reflex. This sort of reflex to be outrageous, to be hard and cold and reject things and put things down. That sort of mechanism has drifted from the left to the right. And it's become, you know, and so a bit like that sick joke, you know, the sick joke that the guy told us that inspired us to start thinking about this topic and led to the book. It's that sort of, you know, defending the right to have this kind of humor that's otherizing or very negative or hostile, you know, that's one of the things that these people are very keen to preserve as as their right to have be offensive, you know, and be outrageous. And so that's one of the things we do look at in the book is where does this impulse to outrage come from? And it's not, and it's something that I, you know, sort of in particular understand because I remember when I was into punk and me and my brothers are into punk, that's the side of punk that we really liked. We were all like, I was like 15, my brothers were 13. You know, we liked this sort of nasty side of punk. It wasn't all just about DIY and wholesome, constructive stuff and rock against racism. We actually liked all the most shocking and awful things about the Sex Pistols or whatever. And so, so there is something about outrage that, you know, it sort of gives you this burst of energy or is sort of weirdly exhilarating. But it then, you know, I think it does ultimately something to grow out of, I think, and it comes from fairly nasty places in the psyche, and that's become very easy to see now that it's sort of a tool of the right wing.
To get back to this shift from left to right, I think one of the for me, the most interesting examples in pop terms is like how Morrissey has evolved in the last couple of years.
Yeah.
Because let's grant him that he's always been like an he always positioned himself as an anti-establishment figure. But this anti-establishment fight was like something that was on the left in the 80s with like Margaret on the Guillotine and this anti-Thatcherism and anti-monarchy. But now, somehow, like with this shift of the rebel image to the right, Morrissey finds himself like also in the position that he's now making very far right political statements, and a part of that, and apart from that, political statements. What I find really interesting in terms of gender is that Morrissey once was one of these androgynous, soft man that really did like perform a new kind of masculinity, like not at all this. Okay, he was obsessed with James Dean, I guess, but still, it was like it was like a softer and more open kind of masculinity. And looking at him now, like he completely dropped that. I think.
Like I think his body changed. I think I noticed, like, I saw him on stage on TV, like 5 or 10 years ago, and I thought, oh, he looks like a bouncer now. He's got a great big body, and he carries himself
as in doing sports,
like a bouncer, like someone outside a nightclub.
Yeah, okay,
yeah. But like on stage, he's quite heavy set. Like he's not. he's still a very solid guy. You know, when you in the Smiths in the 80s, he was sort of thin and kind of delicate, tall, but like very sort of not muscly. But now he's like this solid guy, and I think that's part of it. I think he also does. He did always have a fascination for sort of rough delinquent youth and criminals as well, which is a funny, I don't know if you have it here, but in Britain there's a funny interest in gangsters, like the Cray twins, these sort of East London mob, and people say, you know, well, they were violent, but they only, you know, they only killed each other, the other gangsters, and it was safe to walk on the streets if you were an old lady, and they were like, you know, they kept their parts of the East London nice and clean, you know.
Great.
You know, they broke a few legs, they killed a few guys, but you know, there is this weird thing, cult of the English mob, and I think Morrissey was fascinated by those sort of people. So that's what his kind of vibe now is, that he's sort of like, he's quite sort of tough looking.
But also, I think it also reflects like in his music, like his recent solo albums, like since Viva Hate or Ringleader of the, now that Viva Hate is the first, like You're the Quarry and Ringleader of the Tormentors, it has become like a much more straightforward rock with all this like very loud drums, like bangy and very like, it's like a very, for me, a very boring form of like this straightforward, very masculine rocker.
It's a shame because his representations of men and women and desire and love and everything in his songs in the 80s was so interesting. Like, he did this amazing song, Wonderful Woman, that was just a B-side. I think it's a portrait of his friend Linda, this very interesting post-punk artist who was his friend. But, you know, it's this this picture of this, I don't know, this what free-spirited woman who will just do anything for amusement and like leading Morrissey into all kinds of adventures and trouble. You know, and then he did other songs that were like, there's no gender specified. You know, it could be a love song addressed to anyone, any gender. And often he's the delicate one in the songs, the one who's being overpowered, he's very often unrequited and vulnerable. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a wonderful, and the funny, I think, I remember with the Smiths, I think he did have gay fans, but a lot of his fans were straight guys who something in his music, the way he sang, opened something up in them. Like, you can see these guys were very kind of tough looking, like they looked like they were into sports, singing a song like Reel Around the Fountain with all their heart. And it's a very unusual, vulnerable song, kind of a passive song. But they were, I think Morrissey unlocked something in a lot of his male fans who were outwardly quite straight, regular people. But, you know, in the same way that Bowie did in his day, and, you know, Mark Bolan and all these people, there's a sort of this androgynous British pop tradition that Morrissey was part of.
But the But acts like Bowie or even the Rolling Stones, who kind of brought cross-dressing and that kind of stuff into their rock music. I think people today sometimes argue that, well, these musicians, I think they didn't mean anything bad. I mean, look, they like women. They even dressed as women themselves. Like, they were kind of trying to be a bit queer, but I think it's
Mick
very...
Mick Jagger has makeup on. He can't be like a misogynist. Yeah. He wears eyeliner.
Well, one thing these guys discovered is that dressing like a little bit feminine, wearing a little bit of makeup, girls really like that, you know. So, like Brian Eno, when he was in Roxy Music, had a very feminine image and, you know, long hair, but sort of feathers and makeup and stuff like that. And he just had girls flocking to him. And I think that's one of the things is that actually, I think some girls like a guy that seems to have this sort of gentle feminine quality or a kind of pays attention to the way they look or whatever. You know, it's considered very appealing. It's sort of part of that Mick Jaggerish glammed up dandy thing that is, you know, it works.
Yeah, but it's kind of still only on the foreground of this image, of this rock star image. It's not like a real thought about queerness maybe and, you know, accepting the other gender.
Yeah.
And it's equality. Right? It's just more like a masquerade.
Yeah.
Or maybe at that time.
Or maybe even an appropriation of the freedom to be, you know, flamboyant or whatever.
Well, what's interesting when we're talking about is I'm thinking that all these these conceptions, like, they build on very stereotypical ideas of what it means to be like a man or a woman. You know, that's also interesting.
And then they flip them around. Yeah. But they're still keeping.
Yeah, it's still like very stereotypical.
It's not binary.
It's very binary. That is for sure. And it's still like two equal, like, pretty means like female, and not caring about yourself means male. That is very stereotypical. Yeah. And even if you flip it around, it's still like
within those terms.
Yeah, it's still a stereotype and very binary.
Well, I suppose what's interesting about recent years is just how there have been so many new fractions of gender and a lot of stuff that's just trying to be undefined and, like, blurring everything up.
Yeah. The picture has, I think, luckily become more complex.
There's this book, you probably saw it or read it as well, by Breanne Jones and Ellie Davis. They published a book called, what's the name again? I got it written down somewhere. Under My Thumb, Songs That Hate Women and the Women Who Love Them, which is basically what you talk about in your and Joy's book as well. And there are several essays written by women from their point of view, why they like, why they are. They kind of discuss with themselves as well in the essays. And what you kind of read through the lines is that they reclaimed songs for themselves, like sexist or misogynist songs that they used to like, and then they kind of got what the lyrics were really saying. And then they thought, okay, well, but still, I interpreted it in a totally different way, which is like the way I can really connect to it. So they kind of reclaimed these sexist or misogynist songs again for themselves, which I find quite an interesting approach. I think this is something that has been on your mind and Joy's mind as well, probably while writing that book, that you kind of... It's the problem with still being a fan, like, knowing about these lyrics and, I don't know, what do you do with that? What do you do with the new information?
Well, it's become a big topic, hasn't it? And it's not just because of, say, the content in songs that you don't like or disapprove of. It's also the behavior of certain artists in their real life as well. So those are actually different things, but it feels like the same thing, because in the end it's still like, how do I deal with my enjoyment of this thing where there's this bit that it's like, you know, eating a delicious piece of cake but there's a nail in it, you know, and you cut your mouth on it. You know, it's like you're seduced by the music and pleasured by it, but there's something that holds you back from fully going with it or being involved in it. I find it easier to deal with content in songs that is troubling. It's the when people have done awful things in real life that is like the thing where it's actually very hard. Like with Michael Jackson, that some of my favorite music of all time, and I haven't listened to it since all the revelations came out. But I wonder how I'm going to feel the next time I hear, because it's still music you might hear by accident, you know, in a shop or somewhere on the radio, and a song comes on, you want to like go with it, and then you think, oh, but this guy then went on to do that, and you can invent sort of weird rules, like, you know, say, well, probably probably around the time of Off the Wall, he hadn't done any of this stuff yet. So maybe Off the Wall is okay. Thriller, I'm not sure, because that was, he was already starting to do weird cosmetic surgery and was very eccentric. Definitely by the time of the Bad album, bad things are happening. It's like, but really, if someone does bad things, then it sort of should affect everything. You know, everything connected with them is somehow contaminated, you know. But I don't know. But then again, another part of me thinks that it's unreasonable to expect artists to be model human beings or have correct opinions, especially.
Yeah, I think that's not the point, really, actually. Yeah, I think it's not the point. And I think this is one of the main problems of our times that kind of goes through politics a lot as well. Cancel culture, like people who think you can't say anything anymore. Artists need to be like angels, which is really not the point. It's about like looking at the structures behind that behavior, which is not like blaming only certain people. I think it's not so difficult. I think it's about not being like sexist or being like an asshole.
And being
aware, maybe like being aware of our times and like the structures of society. And that
your own like position and role, like as, for example, as a white cis man, like of my privileges and my part in these structures and my part in the patriarchal system, even though
you try not to.
Yeah, even though I want to fight the patriarchy and I want it to be gone, like I still profit from it.
Yeah.
So, yeah. One thing... because I think you're a big fan of Nick Cave, right?
I was. I haven't listened to his albums for a long while, but I did really like him in the 80s.
I really like Nick Cave too. But recently, I've started reading. I don't know if do you follow his blog, The Red Hand Files?
I don't, but I've seen he's written these very nice letters to fans about stuff, and he does seem to. He seems to sort of. I mean, obviously, he's been through like the worst thing that can happen to someone, in a way, is the loss of your child. But he seems to just matured into this very kind, fatherly figure towards his fans. And it's very sweet, I think.
It is, on one hand, but like a lot of the stuff that he writes, I personally find very, I find just stupid.
Really?
Yeah. For example, like just wanted to ask what you think about that. There's one fan and he asked the question, what are your thoughts on the current state of modern rock music? This is the question like that Nick Cave gets, and he answers, not so long ago, the big idea in the world was freedom of expression. And he goes on, like, it looks like the new big idea is moralism. Will rock music survive this one? We shall see. And then he goes on, like he stays in this whole religious image with like moral and pious people and taking away like the dirt and grime of rock. And he says, transgression is fundamental to the artistic imagination because the imagination deals with the forbidden. Go to your record collection and mind erase those who have led questionable lives and see how much of it remains. It is the artist who steps beyond the accepted social boundaries who will bring back ideas that shed new light on what it means to be alive.
It's a fairly archaic idea, or just old-fashioned idea of the artist as this sort of.
And it also sounds like an excuse to me of not like wanting to really reflect upon your own behavior and your own thoughts. Like it feels like the easy way out. Also,
it's a romantic idea of the artist as a criminal, and then the flip side of that is the criminal as the artist, which I think is where this idea of the fascination for serial killers and how weirdly creative they are in the ways they, you know, kill people and create strange mystical patterns in killing particular kinds of people, whatever. There's this sort of weird, you know, that's a very romantic idea, and Dostoevsky, et cetera, to, you know, people who won't do what society expects them to do. And bring back, as Nick Cave was saying, bring back this sort of secret knowledge. But, you know, one of the interesting things is the way this sort of discourse of rebellion and being sort of anarchic has drifted into finance and Silicon Valley, and, you know, and the idea of the capitalist entrepreneur as a disruptor, as someone who doesn't give a fuck, who is not held back by society. You know, it's a particular idea of what freedom is. And it's immature. I think it's like immature in the life of an individual, but also in the life of a species, maybe, you know. And I think actually one of my ideas I've toyed with writing is the idea of a book about set in a few centuries from now when meat eating is forbidden, and the only figures who are remembered from the 20th century are Linda McCartney because of her vegetarian sausages, which everyone says are the best vegetarian sausages in the world. No, Paul McCartney is forgotten, but Linda McCartney is, like, there are statues of her. And Morrissey is actually forgiven for all this stuff because of him being such a prominent animal rights activist. And Meat is Murder is you know, like, the world anthem. But the sort of rebels in this future society are the secret meat eaters. You have, like, underground meat eating raves, you know. I think a lot of what we think of as normal will be seen as, like, this immature phase of humanity. And that's why I do sometimes wonder if the whole rock and roll era will be like, what did they think? You know, what on earth are they doing? And I think sort of, you know, being responsible and caring about stuff, and the sort of this idea of excess and transgression that Nick Cave is talking about, it seems like a historical moment that has outlived its usefulness in lots of ways.
In the afterword you wrote in 1995, you wrote, having exhausted the psychosexual dynamic of male rebellion, rock culture is confronting the possibility that the only new frontier is a specifically female experience that has hitherto been left out of the script. We've yet to see a radical feminization of rock form in itself. What you say, this has come true.
I think there's been a lot of very interesting female, since then, really, female musicians and experimental electronic female artists, particularly. But, you know, someone like Bjork is her career. At the time that we wrote the book, I think she had just put out Debut, which was a record that we both loved, but it was relatively pop, but then she did a lot more experimental stuff. But yeah, there's been plenty of formally, you know, I think one of the things at that particular time when we were writing, most of the innovation seemed to be on the level of content, like of lyrical content and vocal and performance stuff, and not so much sound. So you had PJ Harvey was basically writing very unusual lyrical songs, but it was a kind of blues-based rock she was doing then. Holes had been a noisy group that then became like a commercial rock sound, like a commercial grunge sound, you know. So the modes that were being used were relatively traditional. It was more the lyrical content that was interesting. But I think it's sort of changed for the better now. And there's a lot of, you know, there's loads of, Mika Shu and the Shapes, you know, and the stuff that Mika Levy does as soundtracks. You know, there's just loads of female experimental music, stuff that's sort of on the edge of pop and experimental stuff.
But also, rock as the genre that we've started talking about in the first place, like, I think the best rock musicians nowadays are females.
When I look at the past decade, like the 2010 to today, and I look at the music, the guitar, like, let's say the guitar centered music that I listen to, that is just basically rock music, I realized that, like, almost all the guitar driven music I listened to was by non-male artists. Like,
By who?
I have made a long list of at the beginning of the century, like the Vivian Girls, and let's say Waxahachie, Soccer Mommy, Angel Olsen, Snail Mail, Vagabond, Savages, Cherry Glazer, Phoebe Bridges, Lucy Dacus, Torres, Sneaks, Mitski, St. Vincent, not to forget, JSM, Girlpool, Chastity Belt. I think there's this, do you remember the New York Times did in 2017, they did this big piece called
Rock is Ruled by Women.
Yeah, Rock's Not Dead, It's Ruled by Women.
All right.
And
I must confess, many of them I've not heard, but my listening is much more like beat-oriented electronic hip-hop stuff.
Yeah, this is like, that's also interesting because what we said earlier, that rock is not the big successful genre of our times. And a lot of interesting stuff in rock happens on this like indie level. Like these are, I think these are all like, they're not really big artists. Like these are indie artists. And but what I like about them is that they feel so much more interesting to me. Like the topics they are dealing with, like they feel so much more relevant, because they're not telling the same old stories, like from the male perspective. It's a new perspective, and I'm wondering why it's so hard for like so many male bands and artists today, like in this indie rock genre. They don't have anything new to add to the conversation. They're just focusing on the same narratives. But there's so much interesting stuff to talk about. Like, I think toxic masculinity is a really interesting topic that could be tackled by, like,
from within,
like from like by these like mostly white and male bands. Like, but it's the women again today that like deal, like the only bands I know that really openly and very explicitly deal with that are like female artists. It's also interesting because, yeah.
Well, there would be some examples that we could discuss, like Alex Cameron, for example,
who
takes on the stage, kind of takes on different personas of types of being male.
Are you familiar with Alex Cameron, or is
no, okay. I don't know.
Like he's not also, I guess he's not that like not that huge, but I find him very interesting because, as you said, like he's impersonating in his lyrics, he's impersonating a lot of like problematic males and problematic behavior. Like he shows what toxic masculinity is. Like he impersonates this like this homophobic and misogynist guy. And he does it in a very ironic way.
Right.
But my problems, I did an interview with him like in the summer, and he's very aware of all the problems. And he also says that he wants to use his like elevated position on the stage as an artist to like to talk about men, how problematic men can be. But then again, I don't think that his audience gets it. Because
he's not really talking to them, he's only singing to them, and you need to be aware
very
of the lyrics
ironic.
And understand the level of irony, definitely. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm not saying that like every artist has to be like an outspoken activist, but it's...
Maybe if you choose to go that path, maybe...
Yeah. And I think if you're aware and if you're happy to talk about that, and if you say that, this is important to me, I want to use my position as an artist to change something in society, then I think you have to deliver a bit more.
Was there a reason why you wanted to publish the book again in German?
I don't think there was any particular impetus, like feeling like it was timely again. But then when we started sort of thinking about how to frame it to try and make it seem like it was timely, I was like, there are all these things going on where, you know, with the alt-right and with, you know, there's like this website called The Return of Kings, which is all about like going back to masculine dominant values. There's Jordan Peterson, there's lots of things going on in the culture that relate to sort of overtly anti-feminist politics. It seemed like actually the stuff we talked about in this book is still very relevant, or has come back to be even more relevant in a strange way. Although, I don't know if there's as many manifestations of it actually within music itself. I don't know. Do you feel there's like a lot of... I heard there was some kind of... I mean, there are various sort of fascist forms of... music out there on the internet, but
yeah, there's a lot of German rap that is openly like supporting like Nazi ideas.
Is there really?
That's a new thing.
How does that work? How do you have a very black musical form that is repurposed?
Yeah, that is working perfectly.
Right.
Like, the German rap is like the most successful genre in Germany for years now. And yeah, it's super weird, this paradox. It is like it's
combining the most popular with yeah. your own ideas, I guess, even if it seems widersprüchlich.
And that's super, and it's like it finds a lot of listeners. Like, and it's scary. It's really scary because how do you call like the identitäre Bewegung in this movement like in German speaking
young right winged movement that is kind of like from a first perspective
they don't look like Nazis.
They don't look like Nazis.
They look like hipster Nazis.
They can also. The way they their images and the way they talk and they kind of hide like
but they're completely
they've become really popular
extremists
also in Austria
and like a lot of these
they like hip hop
because they like they do a lot of things that are like cool in air quotes and like and that's part of their image and like there's a strong connection like to these rap artists and like. And also to, I think we have to mention it, to like terrorists, because I think the, who was in contact, the Christchurch terrorist was in contact with the guy from the Identitäre Bewegung. They were writing messages.
Texting.
Yeah, texting, they were texting.
Sure.
So they are really dangerous.
This is a bad ending.
But we had such a nice vibe going on earlier. Now it's really bad. But we don't have to end on that.
No, we don't have to end on this.
Cut it and edit it.
Yeah. Der Pop-Theoretiker Simon Reynolds war zu Gast bei uns im Podcast-Studio der Spex. Sein Buch Sex Revolts, das feiert 2020, also nächstes Jahr, sein 25-jähriges Jubiläum und es erscheint dann auch in einer deutschen Version beim Ventil Verlag am 15. Februar. Man findet von Simon Reynolds aber auch noch mehr Literatur, zum Beispiel ein Buch über die Post-Punk-Ära, ein Buch mit dem schönen Titel Retromania oder das Buch Glam, in dem es um Glitterrock und Artpop geht. Hier im Podcast geht's jetzt weiter mit einer neuen Kolumne, Planet Kanak, eine Kolumnenreihe von Musikerin und Rapperin Ebbo.
Hey Leute, mein Name ist Ebbo, willkommen zu meiner Kolumne Planet Kanak. In meiner ersten Folge spreche ich über den Begriff Female Rap. Ich komme gerade von einem Shooting, wo mehrere Rapperinnen aus Deutschland abgelichtet worden sind. Und keine Ahnung, ob ich mir vor 5 oder 6 Jahren hätte vorstellen können, dass es mal so viele Rapperinnen geben wird, die vor allem im Mainstream stattfinden. Ich schätze, man muss sich an dieser Stelle auch bei Nicki Minaj bedanken, die auf jeden Fall einen großen Teil dazu beigetragen hat, Frauen wieder zurück in den Mainstream-Rap zu bringen. Was ich auch großartig finde, ist, dass wir alle in verschiedenen Sparten des Raps auch stattfinden. Es gibt den sehr kommerziellen Rap, bis hin zum Underground, Conscious Rap und trotzdem wird alles gerne über einen Kamm geschert und in eine Sparte gepackt und die ist Female Rap. Nicht nur, dass diese Unterteilung super binär gedacht ist, sie sagt im Grunde auch aus, dass Frauen im Rap nicht auf demselben Level sind wie Männer. Dass all die Typen im Rap nicht zu vergleichen wären mit allen anderen, die gleiche Musik machen. Es stellt auf jeden Fall die männlichen Kollegen auf ein ganz anderes Podest und ich frage mich auch, woran wird überhaupt gemessen, was bessere Rap ist? Manche RapperInnen haben einfach krassere Techniken, setzen sich damit mehr auseinander und andere haben wiederum gewagtere Flows und spielen mit ihrem Style. Und ich frage mich auch, wer das bestimmt? Wer bestimmt darüber, was der bessere Rap ist? Sind es Klickzahlen auf Spotify? Ist es YouTube? Oder ist es am Ende des Tages an Musikjournalistinnen, die das festmachen. Ich meine, Rapperinnen wie Shireen David, Noura oder Unique zeigen ganz klar, dass sie auf all diesen Ebenen erfolgreich sind und trotzdem wird selbst bei ihnen eine Unterteilung gemacht. Sei es das, für was sie kritisiert werden, also im Vergleich zu ihren männlichen Kollegen, für Erscheinungsbild, für die absurdesten Dinge, für die männliche Kollegen niemals zur Rechenschaft gezogen werden würden, sei es Interviewfragen etc. etc. Und gerade deswegen finde ich es sehr, sehr schwach oder auch schlichtweg falsch, eine Unterteilung zu machen zwischen Male- und Female-Rap. Mag sein, dass die Inhalte voneinander abweichen oder dass der Style anders ist, aber der ist auch anders zwischen all den verschiedenen Sparten von Rap. Der ist bei jeder Rapperin anders. Und gerade deswegen sollte man auf solche Unterteilungen nach Gender verzichten, weil es nichts über die Musik aussagt. Deswegen bitte lasst uns den Begriff Female Rap abschaffen. Es ist alles Rap und alles lieber an all meine Kolleginnen da draußen, die ihren Sound machen und sich nicht in irgendwelche Sparten einteilen lassen. Das war's von mir. Danke fürs Zuhören und bis bald. Planet Kenneck.
Zum Abschluss dieses Podcasts hier noch ein Veranstaltungstipp für euch. Blumfeld, Tokotronic, Die Sterne, Die goldenen Zitronen, alle haben sich, wenn auch unterschiedlich, Anfang der 90er Jahre an einer westdeutschen Bürgerlichkeit abgearbeitet und den Diskurs um deutsche Popmusik stark mitgeprägt. Nach dem Mauerfall gab es für die Ostberlinerin und Musikerin Mascha Kreller da wenig Anknüpfungspunkte. Ihre politische Realität war einfach eine ganz andere als die der westdeutschen Bands. Im Popdiskurs allerdings blieb die ostdeutsche Erfahrung unsichtbar. Nicht verwunderlich, dass Mascha Kreller bis vor kurzem ausschließlich auf Englisch gesungen hat. Dann entdeckte sie Texte von Heiner Müller und auch Werke des Ostberliner Schriftstellers, Dramatikers und Regisseurs Thomas Brasch. Texte, mit denen sich Kreller identifizieren konnte, die ihr nicht mehr aus dem Kopf gingen und die sie schließlich in einem Experiment zwischen Popmusik und Literatur auf die Bühne bringen wird. Die musikalische Performance Woanders feiert am 4. Dezember im Hebbel am Ufer in Berlin Premiere. Wen das interessiert, der liest auf spex.de. Noch mehr, da findet ihr derzeit ein aktuelles Interview von Spex-Redakteurin Anna Fastabend mit der Musikerin Mascha Kreller, die übrigens im März schon eine EP mit ersten deutschen Lyrics beim Label Staatsakt veröffentlicht hat. Live zu erleben, wie gesagt, am 4.12. bis zum 7.12. in Berlin im Hau. Mit Kreller dann auf der Bühne Andreas Spechtel, Tarwater, Dirk von Lotso und auch Marion Brasch. Damit war's das schon wieder für diese Ausgabe des Spex-Podcasts. Wenn ihr Feedback habt, dann freuen wir uns darüber. Dann lasst uns daran teilhaben. Schreibt doch einfach eine Mail an podcast@spex.de oder hinterlasst uns direkt dort eine Bewertung, wo ihr uns zugehört habt. Nächstes Mal schon die letzte Ausgabe des Jahres. Da geht es natürlich, wie könnte es anders sein, um einen musikalischen Rückblick auf das Jahrzehnt. 10 Jahre in 10 Alben. Was war wichtig? Was hat das Jahrzehnt musikalisch mitgeprägt? Die Spex-Redaktion wird sich im Podcast-Studio zusammenfinden, um darüber zu diskutieren. Es erwartet euch in der nächsten Ausgabe dann auch eine neue Kolumne, Gegenwartsfunde von und mit Klaus Walter. In diesem Sinne hören wir uns wieder in 2 Wochen am 12. Dezember. Bis dahin macht's gut und stay spexy!